I'd like now to welcome Michael McGuire. He's an environmental engineer and writer. He's author of the book The Chlorine Revolution, Water Disinfection and the Fight to Save Lives. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much.
So there was what you call the Chlorine Revolution, which happened at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. What was the drink, and you focus on the east coast of the United States, what was the drinking water situation like at that time?
There was a tremendous concentration of people in cities in the eastern part of the United States. These cities grew very rapidly, and they did not really take into account how to get rid of their waste or how to build a water system. And it just developed sort of haphazardly. The reason why they wanted to, first of all, build sewers was just to get rid of the waste. This was the time of the miasma theory of disease, when everything that smelled bad would cause disease. And so they wanted to get the smells out of the city. And so they built these sewer systems and took the sewage and put it in the closest body of water, which unfortunately was a river or lake. That was somebody else's water supply. And they also built centralized water systems to fight fires. There are many examples of cities burning to the ground, like Chicago, the Great Chicago Fire, because they didn't have adequate water. So they built these centralized water systems and these centralized sewer systems, and essentially what they created was a very efficient disease delivery system.
Right.
And it really came together in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, and people were dying by the hundreds of thousands every year from disease caused by water.
What kind of diseases were we talking about?
Primarily typhoid fever and what generally are lumped together as diarrheal diseases.
Cholera.
Cholera not so much. Cholera was taken care of in the 19th century by keeping out the people who were infected by cholera, by quarantine. So cholera started in the Ganges Valley in India always. There were seven pandemics. And it spread throughout the world by transportation. And so England and the United States really solved the cholera problem by quarantine. But typhoid fever and diarrheal disease is caused by bacteria and different viruses and different protozoa were rampant in the United States, killing not only adults but also young children, especially below the age of 1 year.
And the mortality rate for children was just unspeakably high.
It's truly shocking today to look at the statistics and see what the death rates were. I've seen death rates in cities as high as 40% of the children born died primarily diarrheal diseases. And it was almost exclusively due to contaminated drinking water and contaminated milk, which were, of course, related. Because, in fact, in many cases, people diluted milk with water and they washed the things that they used to produce milk in contaminated water. So it was a situation that was really stacked against children. And once they got diarrhea, and especially in the summertime, they didn't stand a chance.
Meanwhile, the treatments for those diseases are what we now look back on and say, oh my God, horrible, how could we have ever done that? What were some of those treatments?
Well, there was no treatment back then. These were essentially self-limiting. Either your body fought it off, especially the children, or they didn't and you died. A really good example of this is the father of Dr. John Leal, who's one of the central characters of the book. He contracted amoebic dysentery in the Civil War during the siege of Charleston, South Carolina. He suffered from that disease for 17 years before it killed him in 1882. And so there really was no cure until really antibiotics came along.
But I mean, weren't they, you describe in your book, things like bleeding people and other kinds of treatments that were that actually made the diseases worse?
Far worse. In fact, what they used to do is essentially feed people poisons, very high concentrations of arsenic, mercury, and a variety of organic compounds. The list, if you look at the list, you just say poisons. I mean, they were literally giving people high concentrations of poisons, and it was not doing any good.
It does make one wonder, I mean, if that was the standard treatment at that time and it was considered a scientific era, which our time is too, what analogous weird, crazy treatments are standard today?
Oh, gosh. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to be able to comment today. But
no.
I've looked at the history of this. I had to get into the history of medicine in order to understand what was happening at the end of the 19th century. The treatments came about as a result of a misunderstanding of how the human body worked at that time. I think after, 100 years or so, we've developed a much better understanding. Lord knows there's still probably plenty of things that we're doing that we shouldn't do. But back then, it was all about feeding essentially these very harsh medicines to people. And if the patient felt really bad after taking the medicine, that was always the best thing, because they needed to feel like they got something for their money. Purgatives were just the worst thing.
So what theory of disease, you're talking about the miasma theory of disease, what theories were prevalent at that time? Had germ theory come into common acceptance yet?
It hadn't been fully accepted. Louis Pasteur and Joseph Lister worked on the germ theory of disease in the 1860s and 1870s. They published a very important book in the early 1870s. But it still was not accepted because the human feeling, the human understanding that bad smells cause disease is very strong. It's really strong today. Nobody wants to be around a place that smells like sewage or smells like decomposing animals or anything like that. You know that it's bad, and so you want to get away. But back then, everybody, and I'm talking about doctors and scientists and the public, believed that these smells cause disease, and it took many years. There's one woman, Nancy Tomes, who wrote a book that posited that the miasma theory really wasn't killed dead until 1920. And that was a result of the Great Spanish Flu epidemic, when it became really clear that people were transmitting a disease from one to another. So there are vestiges of the miasma theory of disease that certainly took place up until the 1920s. And the germ theory of disease, of course, caught hold. And, when the old generation of doctors would die off and the new generation would come in, it was more accepted.
We're talking to Michael McGuire about the chlorine revolution. So what were the impediments to the acceptance of germ theory? Some people were against it.
Many people were against it. The miasma theory was so firmly entrenched that it's actually a well-known phenomenon in scientific theory and technology. Kuhn has a great book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions that I think has been quoted, millions of times.
Yeah.
It's truly an amazing book. I read it when I was in college, and then I read it recently, and it really describes how there has to be incremental work in the beginning that finds data that maybe would show that a theory was wrong, but then it takes a long time for that to penetrate the consciousness, really, the collective consciousness of the scientific community until what he calls a paradigm shift occurs. And that then sometimes is very quickly, but most of the time it's quite slow, and there are always the hangers-on who never want to let go of the old theories.
And I suppose that's the same for everything. We're on the verge of legalizing gay marriage everywhere, but there are still the hangers-on who think it's wrong.
Absolutely.
And things
yes.
like that.
No, it's really true. And in my field, there's a lot of change that happens because we're always coming up with new technologies. We're always discovering things that are new in drinking water as the science improves and the sensitivity, the analytical methods gets more and more sensitive. And I have a fondness for saying that, change is great. You go first. Because not too many people want to be first.
So let's go back to the late 19th century, early 20th century. A lot of people didn't want to accept germ theory. They were dumping toxins, raw sewage into lakes and rivers and so on. These were vectors for disease. People were getting these horrible diseases. And there were also, you write about how in Chicago there were other toxic wastes like the stockyard waste that were going into the water. How did chlorine, which is a poison, come to be used as a water purifier?
Chlorine was definitely considered a poison, although it was also used as a medicine, which, as we said before, they use poisons as medicines. But yeah, chlorine was in common usage because it was a bleaching agent. It was literally used to bleach clothes, and that was the only thing that was really available and that had chlorine in it was something called bleaching powder. But back then, nobody wanted to have chemicals in drinking water. They thought that, first of all, their food was being poisoned. They knew this because of revelations in the newspaper, Upton Sinclair. The Jungle is an incredible discussion of how our food supply was, at that time in 1904 when he published it, was just simply contaminated by all kinds of things. And people knew this. And people would get sick as a result of eating contaminated foods or taking contaminated medicines. And I think water is really kind of unique in the human experience. And people especially don't want to put chemicals in water, even today. And that's an echo today that is very strong from back then. And these things don't stick around for fun. I mean, these are very strong, I think, human emotions. And back then, they did not want to put any chemicals in water, even if it would have improved the health of the people drinking it, which is kind of astonishing because the death rates for typhoid fever and these diarrheal diseases was so high.
Along with the development of chlorine as a water purifier, you had the development of filtration. What did that look like?
Filtration was developed primarily in England in the early 1800s, and was used throughout England primarily the European continent. But it made a very slow transition to the United States and North America, primarily because the cost, especially during the late 1800s. You have to remember that in this country in the late 1800s, we were building the infrastructure for all the new technologies, telephone systems. Telephone systems were, you know, just beginning to be developed, and municipalities and private companies were investing huge sums of money. The electrical grid, you know, Thomas Edison was putting individual power systems into people's businesses or their homes, but connecting the grid together was something that had to be done. Road systems, you know, we had automobiles finally for the first time. And so the building of roads was a big... So there was a huge amount of capital needed to do all of that. And for reasons I still haven't understood, drinking water got the short end of the stick on all of this. There are a number of examples where a referendum would be held in a city to raise the money to build a filtration plant. And all of the reasons why, all of the health reasons why that's important, but it was turned down because it was considered to be too expensive. And so you have a solution, a potential solution of filtration, too expensive. You don't want to put chemicals in the water like chlorine because you think it's a poison. So in effect, nothing was done. And that's why the death rate was so high.
It does, your book does, really offer an opportunity for the reader to contemplate the change from rural to urban life, which was happening around that time, the change from pre-industrial to industrial life. I mean, now we're many of us, most of us perhaps, are living in cities and we turn on the tap and we don't have to worry about getting typhoid fever and things like that. But there were so many descriptions at that very transitional time of filth. Now, in the countryside, filth, I'm not sure that concept even existed or exists because all life grows out of what we might call dirt, which is, you know, manure and soil and things like that. And they're not dirty. They are what allows the processes and cycles of life to continue. But when those things are separated from the earth and from naturally functioning ecosystems, they become filth and they become dangerous.
Exactly. In a rural environment, there's no question that, you know, we're generating waste. You know, there are animals that are generating waste. But that is taken care of in the natural cycle by farmers who reuse that. They put it on their fields. They know that it helps grow things. But in the cities, there were concentrations of people, but also concentrations of animals. You know, there were pigs running through the street of New York City way into the 19th century, and truly horrific conditions and garbage piling up, and it was really a bad place to live. There was something called an urban penalty for living in a city, where you literally died years ahead of someone who lived in a more bucolic life someplace out in the country. So the cities were really dangerous places, and one of the main reasons was due to contaminated drinking water, but there are also other things like these industrial working conditions, which, of course, killed many people. It was incredibly dangerous to work in industry at that time, especially we had child labor, and children were being killed. There were fires in these factories. So all of this is something that we don't really understand today in the United States until we perhaps hear about the disaster in Bangladesh with the collapse of that factory. This is still happening in some developing countries, and all we have to do is look at our history back in the late 1800s, and it was happening here too.
We're talking to environmental engineer Michael McGuire, author of the book The Chlorine Revolution. So who was Dr. John Leal?
Dr. John Leal was, first of all, a physician. He was trained at Columbia University, undergraduate at Princeton, pretty smart guy. He was also a public health officer. He was someone who worked for the city of Paterson, New Jersey, a perfect example of one of these very crowded, very contaminated cities at the time. But he was also a sanitary advisor after 1899 to some private water companies that were delivering water in New Jersey, in the state of New Jersey. And so he had many roles, and I think that all of those roles really helped him put in perspective the contamination of drinking water and what needed to be done in order to improve the situation.
And what was his view on that?
It's quite clear from his writings and from what he did that he knew that something had to be put as a barrier between the contamination in the water supply and people taking water out of faucets. He worked for a water company that built the first modern filtration plant in Little Falls, New Jersey. And so he knew that that was certainly the way to go, but he also knew that that was very expensive. He was looking for something relatively inexpensive that would be effective. And from his testimony at the two trials later, we know that he actually did laboratory experiments. He took samples of bacteria and applied different disinfectants to them, like chlorine, and saw that at very low dosages, you didn't have to put in very much, it really killed the pathogens that were making people sick. And so it became quite clear that he saw that as the answer, and he was looking for an opportunity to apply it.
And he succeeded.
He did. One of the water companies he worked for was called the Jersey City Water Supply Company. And that water company had a contract with Jersey City to provide a new water supply from the Rockaway River. That happened. They built a dam. They built a 7 billion gallon reservoir and a 23-mile long pipeline to Jersey City. But the city sued the water company because they said, it's not pure and wholesome, and that's in the contract, so you have to provide us water that's pure and wholesome. After looking at this for some time, I became convinced that this was a negotiating technique. I mean, this is New Jersey, right?
It was then,
and it is now. Jersey City is always amusing to read about. But Jersey City was very serious, though, about also making sure that the water supply was cleaner than it was being provided to them. And there was a lawsuit. And the judge agreed that sometimes during the year, the water was contaminated. They wanted the water company and John Leal to build sewers up in the watershed to take away the sewage, but Leal knew that wasn't going to work because he knew about rainfall washing off animal manures and other things from this rural area, and he knew there would still be bacteria in the water. So he asked the judge if he could try something new, and the judge put in the final decree, the opportunity for Leal and this private water company to install and test out other plans or devices that would be as effective or more effective than sewers. So that's what Leal did. In the interim between two trials, he hired George Warren Fuller, who was a really terrific engineer back then, and in 99 days, Fuller designed and built a chlorination system which had never been done before in the U.S.
And that was the first step toward essentially universal chlorination in the United States.
It was. And it's just hard to imagine how fast that technology spread after the second trial, and the judge said that indeed it was safe, reliable, and effective. And then the New Jersey Supreme Court agreed with the judge. and the use of chlorine just exploded across the United States. And remember, before I said that it was very hard to get technology to change things in the drinking water business because of chemophobia, but also because of expense. Well, this was inexpensive, and apparently everybody got over the chemophobia part of it.
When they stopped dying.
In fact, that's really, it's just amazing. If you look at the statistics, they put in chlorine in Chicago, and the death rate just plummeted,
and
many other cities. And so they finally realized, okay, there is something we can do about it. 5 years after the installation of chlorine in Jersey City, 21 million people in the United States were receiving chlorinated water. That was 50% of the municipal water supplies in the United States, which is just amazing. And then a few years later, it was three-quarters of the municipal water supplies were receiving chlorine. So it really was implemented very, very quickly.
And so now we have it in our water systems everywhere, and a lot of us use Brita filters then to take it out again.
That's right. And, you know, that's great. I think that if people want to improve the taste of their water, using a little activated carbon is terrific. One of the biggest complaints about chlorine, even back at the turn of the 20th century, was the taste. And so that was one of the reasons why Leo used such a small amount, really a fraction of a part per million. We have to use more now in order to meet the regulations, and certainly people don't like the taste of chlorine. And a Brita filter or any other kind of pitcher like that that has activated carbon in it will do a good job of taking out the taste.
What are the challenges in drinking water safety today?
We're trying to understand what is really in drinking water and what are the toxicity levels. When I first started working in this field in 1969, a very long time ago, we could measure parts per million. We are now measuring fractions of a part per trillion, which
is an
astonishingly small concentration. And when we look at that very low concentration, we're finding a lot of things. We find ultra trace concentrations of personal care products, ibuprofen. Ibuprofen doesn't degrade very fast, and if you look in drinking waters that are on rivers, you will see ibuprofen at parts per trillion or even fractions of a part per trillion. What does that mean? So we're not trying to struggle with what's important and what does it mean to have these trace concentrations. It's going to be a long conversation because the toxicologists have to catch up to the chemists and how fast all of this is moving.
So we know the stuff is there, but we don't know whether it's bad for us, how bad it is for us, and so on.
That's right. I have to believe that the human body is a bit more capable of dealing with, a variety of assaults, depending upon the concentration. As I think Shakespeare said, the dose makes the poison. If something is in a high enough concentration, it will, of course, kill you. But in these very small concentrations, it's hard for me to believe, just as a layperson, I'm not a doctor, but it's hard to believe that the human body doesn't fight off these assaults of very small concentrations. But we'll see. There are a lot of people that are working on this.
Michael McGuire is an environmental engineer and writer. He's author of the book, The Chlorine Revolution, Water Disinfection and the Fight to Save Lives. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Charles McKay. He's General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to see you again.
And we are sitting up here at the opera, which is just abuzz with apprentices and singers and musicians and all sorts of activities.
Oh my goodness. We started staging rehearsals yesterday and had our first musical rehearsals last week. So we have the casts for Marriage of Figaro and the Grand Duchess in town, and all of our apprentices, and of course all the people who work backstage. And so for the next several weeks, we'll be getting these waves of more singers as we welcome the casts of the other three productions for the year. And by the time we get to opening night, we will have something like 700 people on the list for the opera, employees and independent contractors.
One of the things that I think people may not know or understand is the massive infrastructure that is this opera. And so you're not only running a company of artists, you're running a basically major physical plant.
That's right. It's a big real estate operation because we have nearly 200 acres out in the opera property. And I think we're the only opera company on the planet that has a wastewater treatment plant.
Good heavens.
And so we recycle all the water from the theater. A natural thing occurs when people come to the opera and have libations and enjoy the evening. And so all of that ends up going to the wastewater treatment plant, and then it is used for irrigation on the grounds of the opera. And so we have a whole series of rehearsal halls and vocal studios, then obviously the administrative offices, and then backstage, of course, there's a whole army of people, a virtual cavalry, the people who work in the costume shop, putting together the sets, the props. And so that's about 200 people backstage alone to build the physical production for each of the operas. And then we get into the orchestra, which is 58 players, and we have all the music staff, and then the casts themselves. So it's a huge group of people, but in order to make all this happen and in order to rehearse five operas simultaneously, you have to have all these different spaces and private coaching rooms for the singers so that they can work on their diction, that they can perfect their music and so forth.
And those are soundproof rooms so they don't hear the next person doing the same thing.
That's right. And of course, all of these buildings have to be maintained throughout the year. And then we do a lot in the way of entertaining and welcoming our donors, and of course have a facility here, a kind of cafeteria, if you will, the canteen, where people can come on their lunch break and have lunch. It's not really feasible for people to drive into town and get lunch because the schedule is pretty tight. Generally, singers are rehearsing from 10 to 1, then 2 to 5, and then may have evening rehearsals or performances. So it's very, very complex, the whole operation. And then in addition to the physical plant here, which entails all the gardens, the parking lots, everything else, we do have an apartment complex that we own in town where we house a number of our apprentice singers and people. So then we have an office in New York. So it does boil down to managing a lot of real estate, and most opera companies, as you might imagine, rent the theater where they perform and may have it for a week or two at a time and may have a separate rehearsal facility and an office and so forth. But we have all of that we own, that we have to maintain and take care of. So it is a big proposition to keep track of all that.
We're talking to Charles McKay of the Santa Fe Opera. Now, how does the opera deal with the reality that we're in a drought and this is fire season and it's basically an outdoor performance space and so on?
It's a very tricky situation. And you may recall that 2 years ago we had some severe fires, again, in the Jemez and in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. And we had very severe smoke conditions going into the opening weekend of the season. And so we had to make contingency plans. We had to figure out how we could move rehearsals indoors, which is difficult since the whole operation is based on outdoor performance. So that was adding yet another level of complexity to everything. And this year, because of the current situation with the two fires, we have started to dust off those files and those procedures and are looking at kind of backup plans, how we would deal with it if we do have severe smoke conditions again.
You are an opera company, an opera campus here, a world-renowned operation, so to speak, and you are also in a genre which is known for having older audiences. What are you doing to cultivate the younger audiences?
We have a very, very active year-round education program that is not only in Santa Fe, but across the state. A very active program in Rio Rancho, for example, in Albuquerque, And then in the outlying communities, we do events in Taos and Las Vegas and so forth. And in the pueblos, we have the Pueblo Opera Program. So we're doing a lot with elementary age kids. And
do they like it?
Do you know, I think they are really fascinated by opera because, for one thing, when we invite them to the youth nights, where they get to come and attend dress rehearsal, I think they are amazed to hear these voices soaring over the orchestra without amplification. And then to see that it's, you know, it has lights and scenery and costumes, that it's really multimedia and telling a story. So there's a lot happening visually, which is very engaging for kids. And so they, you know, they always cheer for the hero and boo for the villain in the opera. And, of course, this is the way that I was introduced to opera when I was a kid growing up in Santa Fe and came to the youth nights many, many years ago. And I remember being just enchanted by the sound. Number one, the thing most striking to me was the sound of the live orchestra. You know, I'd heard orchestras on recordings, but never live before. And I think the whole experience for kids, I mean, it's just such a sense of occasion coming out to this beautiful setting, you know, seeing the mountains and the backdrop of the sunset and everything and all the people, you know, just watching people and being part of that communal experience, if you will, is very, very energizing. And kids love it. The other, I guess it was last season, probably, I was walking out of the theater at the end of a dress rehearsal, and I was marveling at these kids who were, A, still awake at 12:15 or whatever it was, and were really, you know, talking about what they had just seen, and were very animated. So we're doing quite a lot in the realm of trying to build new audiences. We commission new pieces for young audiences. And last year did Shoes for the Santo Niño. This summer we will be doing a production of Noah's Flood by Benjamin Britten that will involve local children. Members of the Albuquerque Youth Symphony will be playing for that. And then several of our adult professional performers will be in the production, which is produced with the, you know, same values that we approach everything else with. So a fully staged, you know, production with, you know, a director, designers, conductor, the whole works. We also introduced a few years ago family nights, which have been very, very popular. When we offer tickets for select main stage performances at very reduced rates, so that parents can bring their children, and you know, it's really been quite amazing to see the number of people who bring their grandchildren, the kids from next door, their nieces, nephews, whatever. And we try to intermingle them with the adult patrons. And I think there's something very, very special about attending not just the dress rehearsal, but the actual performance. When you're a member of the audience and there's that kind of electricity in the air when you're hearing the, you know, the orchestra tune, the lights go out, and you get to watch the opera. And the response to that has been terrific. We've actually, the last 2 years, had to add more family nights to the schedule. And so this year we have family nights for, I believe, all the operas except Oscar. And that has been a very, very popular program.
And Oscar is the Oscar Wilde premiere that is happening here at the Santa Fe Opera, and that should be a very big and very important occasion. That must have gotten a whole lot of press already.
We are seeing a great deal of attention, and people are coming from all over the country, in fact, from all over the world, to see this opera. It's the first operatic portrait of Oscar Wilde, who was, of course, such a major figure in the late 19th century in England, a great playwright and poet who had a life of operatic proportions.
Isn't that nice? He has a life of operatic proportions and someone finally makes an opera.
That's right. But it was a life of extremes. It went from, you know, incredible success and fame to, you know, having this this trial and being condemned, sent to prison. So he died penniless. It was really quite something, and all for what he believed in and for loving another man. And so he was a very important figure in the history of literature, but also just as a social figure, as a social rebel, if you will, and trailblazer for gay rights. And it's been tremendous to see the level of interest, and I think it will be quite an event for us. David Daniels singing the title role in Oscar, and the music is written by Theo Morrison, with the text by Theo and John Cox, and it's really based on the writings of Oscar Wilde and his contemporaries, and so it deals really with the time of his trial through the time of his death. And it's kind of interesting too that Walt Whitman is a character in the opera.
Right, Desiree and Desiree Mazin are going to be talking about that.
So I'll let Desiree explain how Walt Whitman comes into the picture.
Now, we're talking to Charles McKay, General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. You started as a musician, among other things, is that correct?
That's correct.
An opera musician?
I studied music in high school. I was a very serious kid. And believe it or not, I kept writing letters to the general director of the Santa Fe Opera, because I grew up here, saying that I wanted to audition for the orchestra. And when I was a senior in high school at Santa Fe High, I think he finally relented and said, I've got to get this kid off my back. And so it was agreed that I would be allowed to have an interview with him for a few minutes. And I remember it was a winter day in 1968. I took time out from school and drove my mom's Buick Roadmaster, wore my best Sunday suit. I came out to the opera with my French horn, and when I was called into his office, I took it out and sat there and played, unaccompanied, the first movement of the Mozart Third Horn Concerto. And I think he was so dumbfounded that a kid would do this that he didn't quite know what to say, because I went on and said, would you like me to play the second movement? And he said, no, that's quite all right. He said, actually, I don't determine the extras for the orchestra. You'll need to audition for our principal horn player, who arrives at the beginning of the summer. And so I look back on that now, and I think of that experience. I'm not sure how I would react if a kid walked into my office with an instrument and started to play. And yet he was very polite to me. I think he was sort of stunned at this kid. But sure enough, I kept track of it. And at the beginning of the rehearsal period for the opera, I would call periodically and ask the receptionist, have the musicians arrived yet? And when I found out that they had, then I contacted the principal horn player, and I went to his home and auditioned, and his kids were running around, and his wife also played in the orchestra. And he put me through my paces and asked me to play from memory a whole series of operatic excerpts. And I think they sort of had the mindset that they were going to, get this kid off their backs. And yet, at the end of the audition, he said, I think we have a spot for you, because we need an extra horn player for the offstage orchestra in Der Rosenkavalier. So I was hired for that, and to be sort of an assistant in the orchestra. And
at the age of 18?
Yep. I had just turned 18, had just graduated from Santa Fe High School. And my main job, Mary Charlotte, was, kind of arranging the chairs in the orchestra pit, putting the music out on the stands, and sweeping up the orchestra pit after each performance. And so it's kind of amazing to me to think that I've gone from one of the very, very lowest and physically lowest positions in the organization to being the general director.
And meanwhile, you did all sorts of other things, like box office manager and stuff like that.
And business. And, John Crosby was, I think, very astute, that he realized, in order to prepare me for a career in opera management, because I went to him at one point very timidly, and by then I knew you didn't ask lightly for an appointment with the general director. And I said, how would you advise that I would go into arts management and opera management in particular? And he said, young man, report to the office on Monday. I have a job for you. And I was administrative assistant and fund drive clerk. And but he advised me to seek a management training program at the First National Bank of Santa Fe. And so I did that for 3 years and played in the orchestra from time to time, but then came back as box office manager and then business manager, and then I went off on the rest of my career.
Which was in St. Louis?
First in Spoleto, for Charleston at the Spoleto Festival USA, and then in Spoleto, Italy. Then to St. Louis, where I succeeded Richard Gaddis for the first time in my career, and then 24 years later came back to Santa Fe in 2009. And the very first day that I started as general director, October 1st, 2008, was the day the stock market slid by over 500 points and kept going south. So it was, I don't think the two things were related somehow, but it was kind of a wake-up call and a very serious moment for the opera and for me to figure out how we would navigate through this and stay in the black, because, you know, one of the signature hallmarks of the Santa Fe Opera has been fiscal responsibility. And so I wanted to make sure that everything didn't go to hell in a handbasket when I became general director. And fortunately, we were able to trim the budget some and, you know, made it through that season, 2009, with, I think we had a surplus of $667 on a, like a, you know, $15 million budget or something. And we've managed to stay into the black ink since that time through the generosity of our patrons and friends. And you know, it was a little bit difficult during the recession because there was a little dip in ticket sales. I think people were traveling less. And now we're seeing a nice return. Ticket sales for this year already are ahead of last season's sales. And the end number for last year was an all-time record for ticket revenue. So I'm knocking wood.
Yeah, he's knocking wood.
I do a lot of knocking on wood in my job, but things seem to be going okay. And we're just so excited about this season coming up.
How do you gauge who your audiences are? Do you have demographic data, what they like and don't like? Do you respond? Do you do things in response to their needs and so on?
Do you know, I think one of the signatures for the Santa Fe Opera has been to stay true to the mission statement, which, forged by John Crosby, stated that we would perform standard operas, new operas, and rarely performed works. And to combine established performers and emerging artists too. And staying true to that mission for 56 years, I think, has been one of the keys to the Santa Fe Opera's success. The people know that they can come here and see something that's new and unusual, maybe that's never been performed before or not in a long time, and also that they will have a mix of the standard classics. And so I think if you look at the numbers, the attendance has been pretty strong over the years, and there's been a consistent arc to the growth of the audience. And people we do keep track of our audience. Approximately one half comes from out of state and one half from within the state. And we know that a lot of people come every year from outside of Santa Fe, and others are kind of on a 2 or 3 year cycle that they might go to Europe to see opera, or they might go elsewhere or do something different. But it's a pretty loyal and consistent audience, which is great. And again, I'm knocking wood that we have maintained strength at the box office and the, you know, kind of the consistent bottom line during a period when many other companies are having difficulties and have seen erosion in the audiences and Some companies have had to curtail their number of performances or number of productions, or even to eliminate their young artist programs. So we feel very, very fortunate here. And I think it's a matter of just paying attention and seeking balance in everything. And I think that that balance to the repertory has been one of the keys to our success.
You, as general director, have to deal not only with artistic concerns and with, as we talked about, this infrastructure and with massive amounts of fundraising and with, I can only begin to imagine what kind of interpersonal issues and personnel issues. And right. you've got a lot of, I mean, I don't want to say they're all divas, but I mean, they're opera singers.
Some of them are. You're right.
Yeah. Now, what do you love most about doing your job?
Do you know, it's interesting. There's kind of a cyclical nature to the job that, you know, the fall begins, that you're planning, you're beginning the fundraising, you're starting to sell all the tickets. You're doing a lot of planning for future years. And beginning in, say, February or so, we see the building of sets and costumes, and it's all sort of leading to this crescendo going into opening night. My very favorite time of the year is where we are right now, when all of the people have arrived. And it's, you know, I just have to remind myself, this is what we work for all year. And just getting to meet all the different performers and the young people who are working backstage. And I think the combination of this factor of having the established people who are real pros and who have really been around the block and know their skills and their jobs very, very well, with people who are just starting out. And so you have that youthful vigor and enthusiasm, which adds a wonderful energy and fuel to the operation. And so I think that, again, goes back to the matter of balance. But it's so exciting to me to be at this time of year. And then the best part comes, of course, when we get into performances and we have our wonderful public here, and to interact with members of the audience and to hear what they think. You know, my motto is everybody's an opera critic. And so, you know.
Even those of us who know absolutely nothing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, people are, I think opera somehow brings out the critic in everyone, that people seem very, you know, secure in what they like, what they don't like. And the great thing about Santa Fe is that people are willing to venture into new territory. And, you know, I can walk through the audience on a given night and somebody will say, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And somebody else will say, oh, I liked last week's opera better. Or, why did you do this? Or, oh, please do more of this, whatever it is. Some people like the staging, others don't. I think generally everyone acknowledges the level of polish to the performances, because we work very, very hard to have long rehearsal periods and to prepare everything well and to build everything well in terms of the scenery and the costumes. And so there's, I think, a real level of appreciation. And one of the things I wanted to mention is the patron survey that we did last year, which was kind of amazing, that had a very, very positive response.
Charles McKay is General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a great pleasure.